this conversation, I think, applies more to if you're talking about a deeper mixed or a mono to mono, which I know sounds like something else. You know, it sounds like a fist fight as opposed to going from you know, one only to the other. You can edit that out now. But
nope.
Good evening and welcome to episode 39 of Flags Fly Forever, Baseball Prospectus Fantasy Podcast. I am your host, Brett Sayer, and with me, as always, is Mike Gianella and Mauricio Rubio. How are you guys doing on yet another uneventful Monday evening?
You know, it's two-layer weather in Chicago, which is it's almost a holiday. It's almost a national holiday.
That's an improvement.
Yeah, it was like four or five, but you know, we got it down to two. We got it under control here.
I'm gonna skip the weather update and just say that I kind of miss the days in baseball when all the moves took place in about the span of a month, and I could just figure all this stuff out. Now everything just seems to happen in gradients, and just when I think we're done with a big set of moves, and you know, I knew this was gonna happen. You know, Max Scherzer signs, and he signs with a team with a stacked rotation, and suddenly I have to kind of go, you know, alter everything. Dexter Fowler gets traded. I got to make some tweaks. I just missed that time a few years ago. It was like a month, you know, a month of stuff, and I was kind of done, and I could start prepping for the season.
Yeah, it was a big day. Not only that, but if you're prepping AL only and NL only valuations for auctions already, there were two crossover trades today. So.
Yeah,
it makes for extra things for us to do.
Well, I'll have, you know, believe it or not, I mean, and I'm thinking about this because last year I kind of got screwed because I didn't start prepping in time. We're gonna have those bids up like middle to late next month. I gotta start putting those into the form that we have so that the readers can see it and it looks nice and clean, like now or within a week. So. Yeah, that can have an impact.
Yeah. So it turns out that with Scherzer signed, the Magliore-Dornes Award for the 2014-15 offseason is going to go to James Shields.
Nice.
Yeah. I like that award.
When do you guys think he's going to sign anytime soon? I mean, I keep hearing rumors. I have to think that now that Scherzer's off the table, it's going to happen within the next week or so. But
you know what happens?
2 weeks.
You know what happens with those signings though is that you know they just show up and then happen. Like somebody tweets about it, and then 30 minutes later, it's like, oh, done deal.
Well, yeah. even with Scherzer, like there didn't seem to be a market. We all knew, like with John Lester. There were teams involved. There were rumors. The Giants were talked about. The Cubs were talked about. The Red Sox were talked about. It was what you usually hear with a free agent. Like there were rumors. With Scherzer, there really were no rumors. It was, and all of a sudden, you know, it was just the Nationals. So Shields is going to be even more like that, where I think all of a sudden, some team is just going to sign him. Like you're right, Mal, and that's going to be it. And it's like, oh, okay, that's great.
Yeah. Then we can all move on.
Yeah, it'll be like the Brewers, and it'll mess everything up. Right.
The Brewers. Watch him before this podcast comes out. He will sign with the Brewers.
Yeah, JP, if you're listening, we bear you no ill will, and we love the Brewers.
Yeah, it's not you. It's your your team. Definitely your team.
Yes. So why don't we get the the pleasantries out of the way, you can read all of us at baseballprospectus.com. You can find us on Twitter. I am at Dynasty Guru. Mike is at Mike Gianella. That's G-I-A-N-E-L-L-A. And Mao is at MRubio52. You can reach us via email as a collective podcast at flagsflyforever@baseballprospectus.com. And if you are listening to us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio app, we ask that you rate and review us because it helps more people find us. And the more people that find us, the better we feel. So this week, which you may have seen if you have frequented baseballprospectus.com in the last day or two, is second base week. And we are diving into Keystone as deeply as we have catcher and first base so far. So you can expect a ton of information. On this podcast, we are going to talk, we're going to look back at 2014. We're going to look ahead at the 2015 rankings and talk about all the players that we find interesting. And there are a lot of them at second base. But before we do that, we are going to start with our topic du jour, and it draws from the breaking news of the Max Scherzer signing. The there's always sort of a question as to how much or how little to either bump up or bump down pitchers' valuations when they move from the American League to the National League and vice versa. And being that we have our valuation expert on this podcast, it seems like a good time to discuss it. So Mike actually wrote the analysis, the fantasy transaction analysis for the Scherzer signing, which is, if you're listening to this, is up at baseballprospectus.com. But I'm going to throw it over to Mike just to so you can walk us through your thought process in how you went about changing his price from what it was before to what it is now and the factors at play.
Well, there's a few things. And, you know, first of all, if you're in a mixed league, I don't want to say it doesn't matter at all, but Max Scherzer was going to be an elite before, and he's an elite now. You know, we're not talking about a sudden radical change where this matters all that much. This conversation, I think, applies more to if you're talking about a deeper mixed or a mono to mono, which I know sounds like something else. You know, it sounds like a fist fight as opposed to going from one only to the other. You can edit that out now. But
nope.
Yeah, I figured you won't. That's probably we're going to start the show with. So there's three factors that kind of play in here with Scherzer. And I'll just start with Scherzer, and then we can kind of go into the broader sense. So I'm really optimistic about Max Scherzer for this year with the Nationals. And there's three factors that kind of play with him. The first factor is he's going to be facing the opposing pitcher on a pretty regular basis. He was only doing that in interleague games with the Tigers. Now he gets to do that in all but interleague games. And Brett pulled this stat up. In 2014, pitchers struck out in 36.6% of their plate appearances compared to about a 19.9% rate for non-pitchers. I think some people overestimate that. They just look at, strikeouts for pitchers and they don't factor in that non-pitcher rate. So it's not like it's a 0-1, but you are talking about a situation where a pitcher should jump up, say, conservatively about 10 strikeouts. With an elite pitcher like Scherzer, I think you're looking at more. I believe the high end that I've seen on this, I was kind of looking at these numbers before, is about 30. And Gio Gonzalez, the year he came over, had kind of a crazy rate of 41, but that was an outlier. So with Scherzer, I think you're probably going to be looking at, let's say, 20, 25 more strikeouts. The second factor, which I think is unique to Scherzer, he's moving to a weak division. Now, there were a couple of high strikeout teams in AL Central, but it's not just the strikeouts. The Phillies are rebuilding, and they're really tearing down their roster. If you look at who they have left, now who's their best player now? Is it Chase Utley?
I think it is. Yeah,
it probably is. And I mean, nothing against Utley. I mean, he's still a quality player, but he's not the Chase Utley at his peak. The NL East has lost Justin Upton, Evan Gattis, Jimmy Rollins, Marlon Byrd, and, you know, the guys coming in, you know, Christian Bethencourt, if you pronounce that, Zoilo Almonte, Freddy Galvis, these are not guys who are hitters. This is a big bump, really, for anyone in the NL East, but for Scherzer moving out of the AL Central, I think that's a big move. And the third thing, and this is kind of slight, and I don't want to overemphasize this, he's moving into a situation where he doesn't have Joe Nathan closing and that bullpen that was combustible, particularly at the end of the season. Drew Storrett isn't certainly going to be a top closer, but I think that's a help. I think that's something that could add a couple of wins to Scherzer. So to get to your question, Brett, you know, these are all sort of factors that I look at. And what I wrote in the transaction analysis is that I probably would have had a bid on Scherzer in an AL only out of about 27. I'm trying to decide where to put him in NL only, but I'm looking at probably a $31 bid. And in an NL only, I think the only pitcher I have ahead of him is Clayton Kershaw right now.
Yeah, so who else is – I mean, let's talk specifically about that while you bring that up. I mean, who else is in consideration for that second pitcher in NL-only formats behind Kershaw?
Well, you'd probably be looking at Wainwright, although I think while the reports right now on his health are positive, I think you have to kind of take them into consideration. Madison Bumgarner – is probably the best candidate for that number two. Although I think some of that, it's hard to say you're overvaluing his postseason because he had a postseason for the ages. But I think he's getting bumped up a little bit for that. He hasn't earned over 30 yet at all. This is what's interesting about the NL, and I don't have this in front of me, but Clayton Kershaw, before Scherzer came in, I was kind of looking at him as a guy who I might be willing in an NL only to bid 40 or over, which I haven't been willing to do for a pitcher in some time because there is so much separation with him and the rest of the league. And guys like Bumgarner, guys like Strasburg, as good as they've been, they haven't cracked 30. Johnny Cueto cracked 30 last year, and I believe here in 37 or 38. But that was coming off of a year that it was a down year for him, and I expect some slippage from him this year. You know, so if you're asking that number two, is I think Bumgarner is the guy that would kind of jump out at me as the guy who would be the number two if it wasn't Scherzer.
Okay, so who are the moving into the non-Scherzer example? Who are the what are the types of pitchers that you would expect to see the biggest bid jumps when going from American League to National League? Are you talking about your high strikeout pitchers with the biggest jumps, or is it something else?
I think the strikeouts are some of it, and you know, we can tie this back to the mixed conversation in that, you know, John Lester is a good example. John Lester, and he had a big strikeout year last year compared to what he's done. I don't think he's a huge strikeout pitcher, though, historically. Generally speaking, when you get into the middle tiers, you know, kind of a rule of thumb, if you have a bid for an NL only and an AL only, there's probably about a, you know, it's what I mentioned with Scherzer, it's probably about a $2 to $4 separation depending on the pitcher. And it's a good way you bring that up, Brett. Like, it's a lower strikeout guy, like a Doug Fister, you might kind of mentally bump them up just like $2. If it's a higher strikeout guy, that's where you might do the three or four. Like Lester's an example of someone who's in the middle of that for me. I think if he were in AL this year, I would have him at, say, a $20 bid. I believe right now I have him at 22 or 23. And I don't think of Lester as a strikeout guy. You know, you guys, despite last year, you know, do you think of him as a strikeout guy?
I do. I kind of do. Okay. I know last year was extreme, but I think that's in his profile to me.
I don't think of him as a strikeout guy first.
Yeah, but I think the way Brett's putting it is what I'm trying to say. Okay. Like, I think you're right, Mal. I think he's a strikeout guy and that he generates strikeouts. I just don't think of him as someone who can kind of anchor your staff with strikeouts. If that makes any sense.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense.
But to get back to the question, so someone like Lester would get that bump, but I don't think I would give him the same kind of crazy bump that I might give someone like Scherzer. You know, Scherzer has the potential this year to strike out, or I would think he does, potential strikeout over 250. I don't think that Lester is going to do that. Now, I could be wrong, but that's just not something I would expect on Lester based on his history.
Yeah, I think that would be pretty rich for him. But I mean, Scherzer struck out 252 last year. So, yes. I mean,
and Lester struck out 220. So, you know, if you expect that to maintain, I would probably look at like 230, 235 as a realistic number for Lester this year.
Yeah. Also for Scherzer, again, just kind of going back to even 2012, which is when I think the strikeouts really started cropping up. He did strike out 231 and 187 as well. I get what you're saying. I just think in the NL, I do think he can actually anchor your team with strikeouts. I do think that's in there.
Wait, for Scherzer or for Lester?
For Scherzer, sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, he could legitimately strike out 275 batters. That is obviously the high end, and he would need to probably throw 220 innings again. But if he gets that bump, it's not out of the realm of possibility.
Well, it was like David Price last year, although Price had a lot more innings. And I think you're exactly right. Like, I think if Scherzer gets the 220, 270 is not unrealistic at all.
Yeah. So then the opposite end of the question from before, is the drop in pitchers going from the NL to the AL the same either dollar or percentage drop? Is it the same as the gain that you get in going from the AL to the NL?
Well, yes and no. It's similar. Now this is where I think there's a difference between the elites and the next tier. I think with the elites, it doesn't necessarily hold, or even kind of the next range down. And a good example of that is someone like Anibal Sanchez. You know, now last year he only pitched 126 innings, and that's a bad example. But you know, when he switched over, he was good enough that he didn't really lose a lot. I think the mid-range guys and below is where they kind of start to lose significantly, just because it's tougher sledding. There's two things at work here. One of them is that the numbers, and this is a mixed mono conversation. In a mixed league, yes, the numbers do go down because you're looking at a higher ERA. It's a different context. I think last year in draft values, it was like a 0.3 difference between the two leagues. I'd have to go look at that to be sure. So in a mixed league, yes, you do lose some of that. In mono formats, in AL versus NL, though, what winds up happening is that because of that differentiation, the dollar value really doesn't quite change so much. You do lose a few strikeouts, but I find that more of the strikeouts that get lost are kind of with the guys in the middle as opposed to the guys at or toward the top.
Yeah, I mean, in my experience, when you have a high-end pitcher, and I mean a legitimate top 25 to 30 pitcher in baseball, going from the National League to the American League, they tick down a tiny bit, but it's far less substantial than people seem to make it out to be.
I will say, like, we don't have a lot of examples the last few years. It seems like there have been more pitchers going from the AL to the NL than the other way around.
Yeah, there really have been, and that continues this year.
Yeah, R.A. Dickey's like the one big example I can think of like a significant pitcher who switched, who had a top price.
Yeah, I'm blanking on anyone else who fits that bill.
Yeah, I'm looking at the spreadsheets now from the last 3 years, and I have them sorted by price. And yeah, I don't really see anybody who jumps out as a league switcher.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Huh. Well, and I think that's having some of an impact on the mono too. Yeah, you know, as we talk about this, I'm reacting to the Scherzer news, and I'm saying I'm going to be aggressive on him. But what could happen is I could very well look at the player pool and decide to tick him down a couple bucks, not because of him, but because the pool is so thick.
Yeah, that's fair. And yeah, to that same extent, I wonder if some of the, especially if James Shields ends up signing with a National League team, I wonder if some of those top AL pitchers get bumped up a buck or so if the starting pitcher pool, you know, remains pretty thin on that side.
I did finish my AL bids, and I can tell you, and you know, you'll like this because he was our guy last year. The guy I have with the starter I have with the sixth highest bid price in the AL. You want to guess who it is?
Sixth highest bid in the AL
starter, not including relievers.
I
gave it away by saying he's one of our guys last year.
You didn't give it away enough. Who is it?
Alex Cobb.
Oh, that makes sense.
I forgot we had Cobb on our labor team. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, if you look at it, yeah, I know we want to.
I love Cobb.
But Cobb is he's a dark horse Cy Young candidate, and I think you know some of that. You know, he came back from the oblique, and if you look at those, I think it was four or five starts, he was awful. You take those out. I know that if you take that out, it's you know it's always you can do that for anybody. But coming off that injury, he had – his numbers were sick.
Yeah, if he gets to 210 innings, that's SP1 all day. That's a guy – that's an anchor.
But it is – you know, it is the thing, and I'm working on the NL bids now. Like, if you look at the AL, you know, after Cobb, who's sixth, you know, you've got, like, Samardzija, Iwakuma. You know, you might have Samardzija to Cobb, and I think that's fair. But there's just kind of a drop-off to these guys, like, you know, Carrasco, Ventura, Gray, you know, Hughes, McHugh, it really drops off. And these guys who were good last year, or someone like Ventura who's emerging, but it's like, well, can they do it again? Whereas in the NL, you've got a lot of guys that you kind of believe in because they've been consistent.
Yeah, there are some really deep rotations in the National League.
Yeah.
And you get a lot of teams.
And you got San Diego with, you know, maybe those guys aren't great, but they've got the park advantage.
Yeah. And even your bad teams in the National League are pitching heavy. And that helps. I mean, teams like the Mets and the Braves are all going to offer, you know, five pretty quality fantasy starters. And,
I don't know what to make of Harvey, though. I have no idea. I think he's being overrated somewhat in the – we're jumping ahead to our pitcher discussion in a few weeks. But given that he's such an unknown right now, he's just getting picked like so far out ahead of where I would pick him.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll talk about this when we get to pitcher week. But I kind of – I'm interested in the corollary between him this year and Adam Wainwright in 2011 when he came back from Tommy John after missing the whole year.
You're going to make me look that up?
I'm not going to make you look it up. I'm just saying that we're going to discuss it.
I'm going to look it up
in 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
I think 2011 he missed, and 2012 was his first year back. I might be off a year, though.
So I have 12 on the 11. I've got to go back into like my zip files and look at that stuff. So. Yeah, well, it's funny you mention that. So Wainwright in 2012 in NL, he earned $15. And you know, it's funny because my bid on Harvey is 16 for only, which I think some might think is aggressive, or I shouldn't say some might think is conservative, but I kind of look at it like, well, we just don't know. Like, he could be solid, but that's a great comp, Brett. Like, I think that Wainwright 2012 comp, if that is the year he came back.
It is. I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, so if he puts up a $15 season in NL only, I'd be pretty happy with that as a Harvey owner and as a Mets fan looking at it like, well, you know, close to 200 innings, solid season, you know, almost a strikeout an inning. Other numbers maybe not great, but yeah.
Yeah, Wainwright's peripherals were really good, but his raw numbers weren't great. But if the Mets let Harvey throw 198 innings, I'll be shocked.
Yeah, I'm thinking 170 might be the high end for him.
Did they ever set a cap? I heard there were rumors getting floated out around. Okay.
No, they haven't set a cap. Or if they have, I've missed it. But
what they're talking about, though, is they're talking about kind of using off days, maybe shuffling someone like Rafael Montero in and kind of limiting him early that way. So that, you know, and you can laugh at this if you want to, if you're listening, you know. So if they make the playoffs, you know, they can have him available.
Man, I'm gonna have to cut this entire first segment off and just attach it to the pitcher section.
Okay. Yeah, it's a tease.
it is a tease, but I think it's a good conversation to kind of turn it back to the beginning. It is a good conversation about valuation, and it's probably good to have these conversations because I know there are some people, you know, FSTA had their draft, and I know it's early to draft, but there are some people that do their drafts in February, and particularly in redraft leagues because it gives an opportunity to trade. So I know there's some people out there that do their drafts in February and are probably thinking about this stuff now.
Yeah, we're going to have our draft in February coming up in, oh God, in 2.5 weeks.
Yeah, that's why I'm hustling to get these lists together, too.
Yeah. All right, yeah. Well, there'll be plenty of labor discussion again this year. If that either excites you or scares you, but it's going to happen either way.
Can you guys?
I think we'll do better this year. Although that's probably the kiss of death that I just said.
Can you guys just be good this year? I don't want to go through that.
Hopefully, we don't have 20 pitchers or whatever was going.
I'm gonna say that we were good last year, and we just got the wrong end of the stick.
That is impressive coach speak. I just want to say
it really is.
It is. I'm like Michael Kadire in the clubhouse.
You are. You're plus makeup guy.
This is the year, by the way. So, like, for people, Brett and I are both Mets fans. Which, if you follow me on Twitter, like, I think some people are like, oh, you live in Philly, you must be a Phillies fan. It's like, no, I'm from Jersey. I'm a Mets fan. This is the year I'm going to get mad about the Mets because the last few years I'm like, they were rebuilding. This is the year they should have spent money and should be good. So I think Brett and I are going to be doing some Met rants from time to time.
Yeah, I would expect that. But
goody.
Sorry,
Matt. Okay, Matt will do some Cub rants because
because they're supposed to win the World Series.
Well, I mean, you guys, you read it, right? It was in a major news publication.
It was. Yeah. It was written in the stars.
Oof.
All right. Well, on that, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back and talking about second baseman.
A million miles away.
Welcome back to episode 39 of Flags Fly Forever. It is now second base time. As we have done in weeks past and will continue to do in future weeks, we are going to take a quick look back to AL and NL evaluations from 2014 and figure out what we can take away from it. So we'll look at the AL first and we'll kick it out. Well, I'm gonna actually start just because this becomes interesting. The $45 valuation on Jose Altuve, we know he was great last year. That is an incredibly high number. What's the? I mean, what just from the valuations? How sort of historic was his season last year?
Well, it wasn't. Like, it's historic. Well, I don't want to say it's historic, but it was a strong season for somebody who is essentially a two-category guy. Mike Trout 2 years ago earned 47 in AL only. So it wasn't that crazily historic. 50 for 5x5 is the number that when you crack that and then in an only league, that's when you kind of stand up and take notice. So it was a really strong season, but it was a combination of that average and those stolen bases.
Sounds good. So who, Mike, who jumps out at you in the AL list here from when you were putting together these numbers? Yeah, obviously outside of the diminutive one.
We always go through this, and you know, I think it was Jeff Quinton at, you know, Monday's Prospectus who mentioned this guy. Howie Kendrick earning 25 and a dollar less than Brian Dozier really jumps out. And in some ways I get it. You know, he had 293 and that's a positive contribution in average, particularly when the average or the baseline is lower than it used to be. But I think you look at a guy with 7 home runs and 14 steals and you think, really? Like he did that well? That's the player who just really stands out. But, you know, on the other hand, if you look at all these second basemen, and Mal and I were kind of talking about this before the show, you know, some of it is the context. Like you look at a lot of these players, that there's one player at second base who hit more than, well, forget 20, than 18 home runs, and that was Brian Dozier. And there were three players, including Altuve, who cracked 20 steals. And, you know, again, it's Dozier, Altuve, and even in a down year, Jason Kipnis. So what we're really looking at here, and you kind of see this at middle infield, and again, this is something Jeff mentioned, you know, today in his other article, you know, in the Quinton series, what you're really seeing is a combination of the depressed offensive context along with the position. You're really looking at some values getting pumped up by some reliable guys that aren't necessarily the studs, the position that you used to see.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And, you know, that was, I mean, I targeted a National League player in Monday's piece, but for more or less the same reason. And that was Neil Walker. And we can, you know, we'll get to him at some point in the podcast, but it's that same concept of reliability and contextual stats in the middle infield really, really add up.
Yeah.
So scrolling down this list, it gets pretty ugly fast after some of the names that you think. But the one guy that jumped out to me, and I never think of him as being a that great of a fantasy contributor, but Dustin Ackley earned $15 in AL only leagues last year, and you know, he hit 14 home runs, but he hit .245, didn't really steal a ton of bases. He stole 8, but the runs and RBI kind of kept him buoyed a little bit in those categories. And you know, if you had asked me before looking at this whether I thought Ackley turned a profit on his expert league bids, I would have said no. But he turned on average a $7 profit. I thought that was interesting.
And yeah, and you know what some of that is that you make the point about the batting average. And I've tried to emphasize this in some of my articles. There was a time when a .245 batting average was awful. He lost money on that average, but he lost like a dollar and change. He didn't, because the batting average last year in the AL, and this is the average that was purchased, was .256. That was the average batting average of the auction or the best auction hitters in the American League. So that .245, while negative, was not as negative as it would have been. And, you know, some of that, and we talked about him before the show, is guys like Gordon Beckham, and guys like Brian Roberts and guys like Eric Sogard and guys like Ryan Flaherty, who are also part of that auction pool, dragging down the batting average. You know, to get back to Altuve, that's part of why Altuve was so valuable. You know, a 341 batting average is going to be valuable no matter what. But when the average batting average was 270, you know, when you go back a few years ago when offense was better, it wasn't worth as much. So that's some of what you're seeing with a guy like Ackley. He's suddenly kind of a solid citizen and a solid contributor as opposed to somebody that you're just like, yeah, I just don't want any part of it.
Yeah, I mean, the batting average thing for Altuve, I mean, you could you can kind of scanning this file, you can see sort of what the positive contribution for average would have looked like in a different category. And I mean, really the number that jumps off here is the biggest number I can find on this sheet is Brian Dozier's contribution in runs. He scored 112 runs, but for him to match Altuve's batting average contribution, my best guess, math off the top of my head, he would have had to score about 170 runs.
Yeah, that might be a little high, but that's pretty close.
It's substantial.
Yeah. Well, and this is, you know, I have this argument with a couple people. This is where it matters less in a mixed league because the mixed league average is higher. But in a mono or a deeper mixed, average, we had this discussion about Joe Mauer last year when we took him. And he didn't work out. But average gets really kind of just pushed aside. Jose Altuve last year carried teams in batting average.
Yep.
He did. There's just no way around that. And to me, the value in Altuve last year, yeah, the steals are great, but the value in him was that, and he earned more in steals. I don't want to, you know, oversell this, but that value in batting average was incredible.
And again, going back to Brian Dozier, just to reiterate this, it was a 2020 season with 112 runs scored. And yeah, the huge gap that he has to make up, 2020 season. So it's like,
yeah, well, but Dozier was also a negative guy in average.
Yeah, yeah, no, yeah.
And again, you know, it's similar to Ackley, not by a lot, but you know, by a little bit. Now, if we get into OBP, which I won't, because we had promised off, you know, offline, this is going to be a shorter segment. You know, he's more valuable there, but you know, it's a whole different ball of wax.
That it is. So let's move to the National League, and we'll start with the obvious name here that jumps out. Josh Harrison earned $27 in NL only leagues last year, and a lot of this is going to tie in with what we just talked about with Altuve with his .315 batting average. But does anyone else jump out on this list? Either in a positive or negative way. Mal?
The analyst? Not really. I mean, I was kind of fixed it. Well, no, wait. My guy Aaron Hill that we were talking about pre-show, he jumps out just between his differences between... I forget Aaron Hill's in the NL now. I do forget that every once in a while.
A couple years too,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, I just he's always in a Toronto uniform in my mind, and I can't really shake that one. But yeah, was it like 160 in mixed and gets like an $11 bump in NL only?
Yeah, he's a replacement level or close to it in mixed, and yeah, in NL only he has some value.
That's insane.
Yeah. I mean, not to totally pile on the whole batting average thing that we're talking about, but I like the fact that Joe Panik earned $7 in less than half of a season by hitting one home run and stealing zero bases.
I do. You know, here's the thing, and you brought up Harrison, you brought up Panik. This is where, when I'm putting bids together, and I get this question all the time because – I sound like I'm contradicting myself. So on the one hand, and we'll get this with the tiers. So on the one hand, I'm praising Altuve, and I agree with you about Harrison. I agree with you about Panik. I'm praising batting average. But when I shave money off of bids or off of rankings, average is the first thing I look at because of the variability.
Oh, absolutely.
Joe Panic's a good example of a guy. If you just doubled his production from last year, you'd say, oh, yeah, he's going to earn $14. You know, but he's a guy I'll probably bid 7 or 8 on in an only, and that might be generous because if he hits 260 or 270 and doesn't steal bases and doesn't hit home runs, he's not worthless in an only, but he's just a guy that I look at and I'm like, you know, I'd rather have the upside of a Jed Gyurko who earned less than Panic last year. But if Gyurko goes out and even hits like 240, could hit close to 20 home runs, you know, or could hit like say 15 to 17.
Yeah. It's past versus future. So,
right.
Anything else before we move on?
Just from an only standpoint, I'd point out, you know, we said Beckham was the 13th best guy in only. The NL definitely was deeper. You had more guys, you know, hitting double digits. And some of that was the dual eligibility. You had Harrison, you had Matt Carpenter, you had Emilio Bonifacio, you had Jordy Mercer. I think if you're in an NL only, it was a deeper pool last year. You do want to be cautious, though, because some of these guys like Carpenter won't be eligible at the position next year. And this is actually a good segue into the tiers. Last year's list is not this year's list. It's definitely going to be a little thinner sledding this year, I think.
Yeah, I agree. So with that smooth transition, let's jump into the tiers. This week's list was written by Mike, and we are going to do what we usually do and go top to bottom. But let's start with the fact that even with the seasons of Altuve and Rendon and the track record of Robinson Cano, there are no 5-star second basemen in the tiers this year. So, Mike, why?
Well, you know, there's a couple things. We debated this about Altuve, and there were two votes on the staff, and I think Keith Cromer had one of the votes, and I think Wilson had the other one, that said we should put Altuve in the 5 tier. Yes, he's going to regress, but he was so far ahead of the pack last year that we should keep him up there. And you and I, Brett, and I think you were particularly emphatic, were like, no, like he's going to slip enough that while he might be close, he doesn't quite belong there. I believe you said that Anthony Rendon and Robinson Cano, you would rank ahead of Altuve, if I remember the conversation correctly.
I would. Altuve would be my third ranked second baseman for this year.
And I kept him ahead of those guys, although I, you know, these rankings are not ironclad in terms of the way they're listed. But I could see that argument. I could see that point. So I think what we're kind of saying with Altuve is that if he only hits, you know, 290 or 300, enough of the other numbers are going to come down. And this goes back to the conversation we had before about the batting average. He'll still be an asset. He just won't be that player that dominates in fantasy. And the tier article is a mixed article in particular. So if you're looking at a 300 hitter in a mixed league who steals, say, 35 to 40 bases, it just isn't the same commodity. And there is some of that risk. In a mixed format, Altuve has to, I'd say, hit 320, 330 to be the impact player that he was last year.
Absolutely. And that really gets to the heart of what – of my view here, and that, you know, the two things that get watered down the most in mixed leagues are average and steals, and those are Altuve's two biggest categorical contributions. So he has to kill it in those two categories, or else he's not going to be worth where he's being taken, and he's being taken towards the end of the first round in some drafts, and
he's going 11th right now on average.
That's just so rich.
It's a little high for me. I can see it. I if I had that 11 pick, it's one of those things I would hope that somebody I liked better was there.
Yeah. So how close to we talked about my preference for this year, but how close to Altuve are Rendon and Cano for you?
They're close. You know, I have my concerns with them as well. and perhaps you don't have the same concerns, I think, particularly with Rendon, because I know you really, really like him.
Oh, he's not the only one.
Be putting it mildly, yes. I think for the second year in a row, I like Rendon a little bit less than everyone else, which this year is a little.
So he's winning MVP this year, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, probably. So with Rendon, I think you have a couple things. There's the steals, which kind of came out of nowhere based on his history. And there's that fear that he's not going to stop running, but that he might steal, say, 10 to 12 as opposed to 17, which would cut into his value a little bit. The other concern I've seen, the power is legitimate, but a lot of those home runs were what they call fence scrapers when you look at the data, where they just kind of barely made it over. These are quibbles to me. I think Rendon is still a superstar. I still have him a couple bucks below Altuve in terms of a bid. But I don't know how much better Rendon can get. I guess that's my concern, which is really damning with faint praise. With Cano, I kind of look at him. You go back now. He hasn't hit for power in about a year and a half, going back to the second half of the Yankees. And it kind of fits the profile of a second baseman his age, where the power just kind of slips. The guy he kind of reminds me of, and this is a great comp, is Rod Carew. He reminds me of a player who I think is still going to be a great all-around player. He's just not going to hit those 25 to 30 home runs he hit for the Yankees. I could even see him hitting 17, 18, 20 home runs for the Mariners. I just don't see that power. So those are the concerns with those guys, and that's part of the reason why, again, to get back to the full five-star, four-star thing, I don't see a five-star at the position. I think of the three of them, I agree with Brett. I think if someone could become a five-star, it's probably Rendon.
Yeah, I think the points that you make about Rendon are fair points to make, but Rendon can get better, and that's the scariest thing about this. Rendon can be a, you know, he might not ever fulfill sort of that power potential that he had coming out of, you know, after his first two seasons at Rice, but he has the potential to be a perennial 300 hitter.
Well, you know what it is too, and I made this point somewhere. He's last year, people underestimated him at their peril. He is a baseball player. Like he is such a good player that to say he can't do this, he can't do that is at your own peril. He could be a stud because he is such a good all around player that projecting him from a standard of, well, the home runs were fence scrapers, or he didn't steal base, or he didn't do this, or he didn't do that, I think that could be the mistake.
Yeah. And, you know, I always go back to some of these conversations from 2009, 2010, where you know, amateur prospectors would be asked. I think this was before, this was the year before Bryce Harper was drafted, when Rendon was still in college. It was maybe a sophomore year of college, I want to say. Mm-hmm. But there were people who preferred Rendon to Harper at that point, and I think it gets overlooked because of the injuries and because he had a down junior season and he fell to sixth in the draft. Rendon was an absolutely elite amateur prospect. Elite. He was one of the best college bats his first two seasons that we've seen in years.
Can I ask you something, though? So, you know, you would have Rendon ahead of Altuve, right?
Yes.
How high up, you know, and maybe you haven't looked at the rankings the way I have. If you had to put a draft sheet together like today,
yep,
where would you have Rendon?
I'd have Rendon probably right around where Altuve is now. I'd probably have him just outside the top 10, maybe in the 10 or 11 range.
Well, maybe 10, because I know you value pitchers lower than, and I do too, than the market is. And Felix right now is 9.
Yeah, there's no way I would take. So you might have Felix, but no.
Yeah, and I agree with you. So you might have Batista 9th and Rendon 10th.
I might have Rendon over Batista in an average league.
Rendon 9th behind Carlos Gomez, who's 8th.
I might.
Well,
I might. I'm gonna put together that sheet and then later this week.
Just let me rattle off these names, and I just want to know if you'd have Rendon ahead of any of those other guys we mentioned. So sure. Trout, Stanton, Kershaw. That's a whole debate, but Miggy, McCutcheon, Goldschmidt, Abreu, and Carlos Gomez. Would you have Rendon ahead of any of those guys?
No.
So Rendon ninth is probably the highest you'd have.
Yeah, I think that's the highest I have him. Okay. I feel like there might be a player or two that are in the 10 to 15 range that I might have above Rendon, though.
Yeah, and again, this is kind of a separate discussion, and I don't want to get off the rails on second base. But, you know, honestly, you know, I'm kind of looking at where I have Rendon, and that's not really unfair. I think there's a couple people I have ahead because of position or because of preference, but yeah, that's not crazy. I'll just say that.
Yeah, I don't feel crazy.
Well, that could be a sign that you're crazy, though.
That probably is a sign that I am crazy. But yeah, I
didn't mean to cut your point off about him as an amateur at Rice, because I've heard some of the same things.
Yeah, I mean it's always worth reminding that the talent was there on an amateur level for Rendon to be one of the best hitters in baseball, and he's getting close to fulfilling that, and it's a really enjoyable thing to watch. But so that we don't spend the entire episode talking about Anthony Rendon, because I could spend the entire episode talking about
you guys. You guys will do that on Tino anyway. So.
There's going to be so much Anthony Rendon talk on Tino, but
we might just call it the Rendon episode. Honestly,
we might.
You know, it's funny. I'm going to probably have Rendon ranked for when we put our labor ranks together, and you're going to be all disappointed. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, say that's Rendon. Okay.
They're a nice mix of our evaluations. So it worked out well last year. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes this year.
Yeah.
So the second part of the four star tier are, you know, guys who have their own flaws. I think there's a pretty sizable chasm between the first three and the second three names. You get D. Gordon, Brian Dozier, and Ian Kinsler. Kinsler is the guy that's really interesting to me, just because he bounced back, I think, better than a lot of people expected in 2014, and he stayed completely healthy. And this is sort of what a full value healthy Ian Kinsler season looks like. So the question is, what it does a projected Ian Kinsler season look like? Because we certainly wouldn't project him for this much playing time. But are the stats that he put up repeatable?
Well, I think so. You know, the funny thing about Kinsler, and you hit the nail on the head, he's an impossible player to predict, because, you know, one year the average isn't there, then all of a sudden he hits for average. He had that 30-30 season in 2011, which, you know, I think people bet on and wasn't repeatable. And then you know, what's really funny about Kinsler, last year I was high on him and I thought there'd be a bounce back, and I bet on that bounce back, and people thought I was, you know, off my rocker, and it turned out to be a pretty good call. But this year I'm not down on him exactly, but I like some of the guys in this tier better, just because I look at those overall numbers and I'm like, well, he was really solid, but a lot of that value came from the runs and the runs batted in, and I'm not necessarily sure how much of that is going to be repeatable or how much of that was luck. I think he's still a really good player, don't get me wrong. You know, in real baseball terms, he was like a, you know, kind of what you're looking at, a 5, 5.5 win player, so he's not going anywhere. But I don't necessarily see him getting better. And then the other – here, you know, this is the funny thing about Kinsler. People talk about the injuries. He's had over 700 plate appearances three of the last 4 years.
Yeah.
This is yet another tangent, but there's people out there, and I remember having this argument. I hear you laughing now. I've had this argument with, like, Ray Flowers of Baseball Guys and with Ron Chandler of Baseball HQ about the idea that you know, once a guy starts getting hurt, he keeps getting hurt. There were example after example last year of players that did not live up to that. And Kinsler has this always gets hurt reputation that I just don't think holds up anymore.
Yeah, it's definitely a it's almost a misnomer at this point, but it's still there's still a lot of people who are not comfortable projecting Kinsler out to play that many games.
Well, I will say projecting anyone out to over 700 plate appearances is just kind of a hard thing to do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing about Kinsler...
I see you there on Twitter, man.
I know you do. I know you do.
The thing about Kinsler is that he got so aggressive last year, which I think caught some people off guard. And I just saw the thing on Twitter, so congratulations.
No. It was funny, yeah.
It was. Kinsler had the highest swing rate of his career last year. I mean, the last 4 years, his swing rates were 42%, 38%, 44%, 41%. So kind of swings, but not all in the same general area. He's 43.5% for his career. He had a 47.8% swing rate last year, swung at way more pitches outside the strike zone, inside the strike zone, everything. He had almost a non-existent walk rate, which is kind of strange for him since he had been putting up walk rates, you know, kind of in the, I mean, he had 12% walk rates in 2010, 2011, but they've been in the 8% range since then. He more than cut that in half, but he didn't raise his strikeout rate. He was swinging and missing at the same number of pitches. So you wonder if pitchers are kind of going to adjust a little bit better to his aggressive approach, but maybe he reverts to his less aggressive approach if they start doing that. But it was just a very jarring change since Kinsler is a guy who always had very even strikeout to walk rates, and last year he just absolutely did not.
Yeah, I never know what to make of that when a hitter suddenly starts changing that profile. It's always strange because you're right, Brett. More often than not, hitters are fairly consistent with how they're approaching. If anything, what's really weird is as hitters get older, they usually tend to go the other way where they swing less and they don't develop a better eye, but they're trying to kind of make up for deficiencies in terms of their bat speed by taking more pitches. So it is kind of weird to see that Kinsler went the other way and is more aggressive.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, it sounds counterintuitive, but it's not really, it doesn't really mean that he wasn't doing that. I mean, just because he's more aggressive doesn't mean he isn't developing a better eye.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, it might, and the thing that's most interesting is that he did it in a season where he changed teams. So you never know how much sort of team and organizational philosophy comes into play with that. I mean, the Tigers, you have the reputation of being a more aggressive hitting team. You have guys on the Tigers who don't. A lot of guys don't walk a ton on that roster. It's slightly different on the Rangers. So you wonder whether that's something that changed when his scenery changed. But that's something that I'm going to keep an eye on this year because, it's going to be a curiosity of mine, even if it doesn't hugely impact his value one way or another. So moving to the three-star tier, there's sort of a mix of the consistency guys and the upside guys, but who, you know, in general, are you knowing what the player pool looks like above and below this tier? Is it a wiser investment to look for consistency rather than the upside of a Kipnis or a Colton Wong here?
I think it's format dependent. this is a theme throughout second base. If you're in a shallower league or a standard mixed league, I think you go for one of these guys and you hope that somebody in the two-star or even the one-star tier can kind of provide you with either the upside or the stability that you need. And you get a little more aggressive with someone like Colton Wong, or you get a little bit more aggressive with someone like Jason Kipnis as a bounce back guy. In a deeper league, I think you have to be careful. And this is where, and I think I touch upon this in the article, this is where a Murphy or a Walker is really a pretty steady guy to go get, or even a Kendrick, you're just going to know is going to contribute across the board, as opposed to, you know, someone like Wong, who could be great. I don't think he'll flame out, but he could hit, like, say, 230, and you kind of suffer a little bit. There's this expectation. I think one of the commenters today at BP said this, and they were dead on. There's this expectation that Wong is going to get better with those extra plate appearances, but it's entirely possible that he craters a little bit and he kind of does the same thing with a low batting average. And, you know, he's okay, but he just doesn't have that growth that people are expecting.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely absolutely fair. And when you're looking at the, you know, guys like we talked about before in Howie Kendrick and Neil Walker and even Daniel Murphy, the amount of bankable stats that you can get from those guys is significant in a deep format, and it should reduce your dependency on the Colton Wongs and Jason Kipnises of the world, or even the guys in the two star tier. I mean, there's plenty of players with upside in the two star tier. It's just a matter of positioning your team with the best chance to bank value at the middle of your draft.
It's I just want to make the statement just overall about the three-star tier at all. On the whole, you were lying about the drop-off being pretty drastic and quick from 4 to 3 to 2. And it's not to say that, as Brett was illustrating earlier, that these players aren't without merit. But when we're talking about Dustin Pedroia and Daniel Murphy and Neil Walker, I think it's a little bit of a different conversation than what we were having even at first base or even at catcher. The drop off's pretty significant here, huh?
Yeah, it gets a little bit worse, but it depends what you think of these guys. I mean, there are plenty of people who think Jason Kipnis is going to bounce back. You have sort of legions of Dustin Pedroia injury apologists. And we already talked about the Colton Wong breakout troop. So there are fans behind each of these individual players here, and you get some of that in the two star group. You know, we'll get into these names, but you have sort of the Brett Laurie resurgence parade, and you get a little bit of the same with Jed Jerko and Aaron Hill. But it's very individual in nature, and I think you're gonna get a lot of people going into drafts and auctions with particular guys in mind that they feel comfortable purchasing because they think they're going to bounce back. And
I said very quickly, just bouncing off of that question, how right do you have to get this position in your mind? How important is this position for you?
You have to get it right because, and we'll get into this next week, because shortstop is even worse, and you're probably going to be playing two of these guys. So you've got to get one of them right. If you don't get one of them right, you're kind of screwed.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think we mentioned this when you see the one star guys here. If you have to take two second basemen, which I think Brett's right, and you do. You really want to make sure that two of these guys are solid. Now, the other side of this, you look at Daniel Murphy, for example. I've done one mock so far, and I took Murphy, and people kind of looked at me like, I don't remember where I took him, but like I was like reaching a little bit. But Murphy, even a standard mixed mock, is kind of a solid guy. He hasn't bounced back to those 20 steals because he's going to hit for that good average. He's going to do a little bit of everything, and he's been on the field. Like, we hope he stays healthy. I think that's the other side of this coin, which is you want two of these guys, but you do probably need to keep your expectations at a level. Like, you're not going to get somebody who's going to light up the world past those four-star guys, which is why, to Brett's point, I agree with everybody. You know, I think Neil Walker, I think people kind of look at him and they think, you know, Neil Walker, he's kind of boring. Those numbers of his, you know, even if he backs, you know, out to say 18 to 20 home runs, those numbers are pretty solid in the context that we're looking at right now.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. But, so let's get into a little bit of the ugly. Let's go down to the two-star group. We have a lot of guys in the two-star group. Pretty much everybody in the two-star group is some variation of a has-been. I believe all of these guys have been either three-star or better at some point in the last maybe 2 to 3 years. I think that's probably a fair statement to make. And while you will find a lot of support for some of these guys in, you know, sleeper columns and, you know, undervalued asset type analysis, everyone still continues to shit on the bottom player on this list, and that's Brandon Phillips. So is Brandon Phillips the worst player in baseball?
Well, no.
No.
Because it seems like some people are making him out to be that. I clearly don't think he is. Just in case that wasn't clear enough. But the point, you know, the point sarcastically stands. I mean, how far has Phillips has clearly dropped, but he's still in this two-star group. He still plays in a favorable ballpark. How bad is he?
He's not bad. I just don't. You know, to use this phrase, there's no there. Like, the speed is gone in all likelihood. I don't see a bounce back coming given his age. You know, he'll be 34 in baseball age. He's just a player I look at where it's like, okay, well, even if some of the power comes back, you're looking at 12 to 14 home runs, an uninspired batting average, and no steals. Which is why he's in the two tier. I think there's a stability with Brandon Phillips. I just don't look at him as a guy who's going to do a lot. And there is that fear the other way, which is if he doesn't bounce back and if he slips a little, there's a bunch of guys in the one-star tier I'd rather have for the upside. I mean, if you look at last year's numbers, the ranking's generous. I think what I'm saying with this ranking is I'm agreeing with you, Brett. I think people saying that Brandon Phillips is the worst, I don't buy. I think there's enough bounce back in him that if he hits 12 home runs, you know, if he does what Utley did last year without the steals, it wouldn't surprise me in the least.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I do not think he is the plague, and I think there is at least some chance that he bounces back and is respectable. I mean, he's a guy who is going to hit in the in a prominent spot in a lineup in a strong hitter's park, and it's not unreasonable that if Votto bounces back and if Jay Bruce has a pretty good season, and it's not impossible that that's going to be a decent lineup. And having Votto getting on base ahead of you is always good for RBI opportunities, and it makes for an interesting buying opportunity if you're interested in sort of picking stocks as they crash and burn into the ground.
Yeah,
but we do have you on record as saying you do not think he's the plague. Yes,
I do not think he is the plague. Yes,
controversial, very controversial.
Yes, although, you know. Yeah, I do not appreciate his treatment of C. Trent, because we all love C. Trent. But
I would well, you know, this is the whole Brandon Phillips is not the nicest guy, or at least it comes across that way. So yeah, it's just something I don't care about in terms of fantasy baseball. But yeah, I get it. You know, if he were in New York, he could very well be like another A-Rod, Lightning Rod type.
Yeah. So going back to the other two star guys, who do you guys think has the best chance of playing their way into the four star group by the end of the season?
Oof. Chase Utley. I'd go with Chase Utley. I think, you know, there's previous track records there. This, you know, good skill set and a good ballpark for him. I mean, you know, some of the other counting stats are going to suffer because that offense is just terrible.
Man.
But yeah, I mean, just really, looking at the other list of this name, like looking at this list, I that's the guy that pops out for me.
What a terrible question. if I had to, and I don't recommend any of these guys, I'm going to go with Brett Lowry. I think Lowry's a guy. It was a couple things. People are looking at the shift from Toronto to Oakland, and they're completely discounting, you know, they're looking at the park switch. But I look at the guys replacing him, Josh Donaldson. You can hit home runs in that park, and I think Lowry's power is legit. Lowry's the post-type guy. He's the guy that for so many years people were bidding him up at third base. He's only here because of the eligibility this year. As a four-star guy, I saw him getting priced in the upper 20s for years in AL only. And now he's a bargain. And I'm not saying it's going to happen. This is the gun to my head on the four-star. I could see Lowry hitting, you know, over the course of a full season, 20 to 25 home runs, bumping that average up a little bit. Of these guys, I think he's the guy who could do it. And again, I'm not saying he will. He's not even my value pick in this tier because he's not the guy getting kind of picked that low. He's the guy I'd go with.
Yeah, I'm with you, Mike, on this one. But I'm kind of tempted to say Aaron Hill, even though I think it's less likely.
He's my value. He's actually my value pick in this tier.
Yeah, he's become totally forgotten about at this point, and it's not wise to forget about him, especially in deeper mixed formats.
I made the point about him too. The injury in 2013. I think people look at him like he's had two down years in a row. He was actually a positive contributor in 2013, but was hurt, so it kind of dampened the numbers.
Oh, he would have been a $20 earner in 2013.
But I think people are looking at the raw numbers, see 2 years of low power numbers, and are writing him off. And I agree with you. I think that's doesn't mean he'll bounce back. He's another player, you know, like Kinsler, and a very poor man's version of Kinsler, who's all over the place. Mm-hmm. But if you told me at the end of 2015 that Aaron Hill had 23 home runs, I'd be like, oh, okay, so that happened. I wouldn't be shocked. I'd be like, oh, all right, well, he did it.
Yeah, but you have these, and this is a strategy I love to take. You have these high variance guys, and their prices go all over the place in auctions over the course of years. And when they're low, you buy them, because if they shit the bed, it's not that big of a deal. If you buy Aaron Hill for $23 or $24 and he sucks, that really stinks. If you buy him for $12 and he stinks, you can get over it.
My thing about Utley, Mal, and you know, I just know this because we had him in labor last year. Those numbers from last year were like the product of a big month. You know, he had an April that was just out of his mind. And you know, thanks to Baseball Reference, I can tell you, you know, through April 25th through 23 games, he had an OPS of, you know, 1,004, and he was just ridiculous. From that point forward, in 135 games, 8 homers, 65 runs batted in, 10 steals, the steals are good, 256 batting average, 705 OPS. Again, you know, take context into perspective, you know, it's still not terrible for this day and age. I just worry at his age and with his profile that he might not have that hot month, and that might be his year.
I'm going to take the opposite approach that I took with Derek Jeter with him, and I'm going to go ahead and give him the old man bump. See, he's got one more dead cat bounce left in there.
I love him. He's one of my favorite players. I hope you're right. just in terms of fantasy, I'm worried.
Yeah, it would make me extremely happy to see Chase Utley be quite excellent again. But
I hope he has five seasons.
Yeah, I mean, anecdotally, that after he went on that hot stretch when he was on our labor team, it seemed like literally all he did was go 1-for-4 with a single for about 2 months.
Yeah.
And those stats seem to bear that out a little bit. But well, let's move on to America's favorite section of the podcast. And that is pick one guy from the rotting carcass down at the bottom of this list. So I don't remember who started first last time. Last time was all thrown off because we had Peter, so we had more one star guys. But let's start with Mike. Who's your one star guy?
Well, you know, there's a couple ways I could go here, and I think the guy I'm going to go with, even though I kind of cautioned about him a little bit, and particularly because some of the moves the Cubs made today, is Arizmendi Alcantara. I get the concerns. I get the fact that he started out of the gate quick and that batting average was ugly. But in terms of the ceiling, you know, there's two ways you can go here. There's a guys like Scooter Gennett and DJ LeMahieu who are just boring. And they're going to do what they're going to do. And as I said before, in a mono format, that's fine. If you're talking about a mixed, I want the upside. And I think Alcantara has that upside. I don't think he's going to get 205 again. I think even if he hits 240, he could provide a lot across the board. And I know that some people think he might not start, or he might platoon, or might play part-time. If he's on the Cubs roster, he's going to play. He's not going to sit for Chris Coughlin or some of the other guys there. So Alcantara is my pick.
He's not going to sit for Mike Olt either.
Nope. Nobody's sitting for Mike Olt.
Sorry if I took your guy now.
All that eligibility.
Yeah, he's really super valuable too if you got the right field, center field, left field leagues that I hate.
Yeah.
He's going to be, if you have one of those leagues where you pick up with just a handful of games in season and it splits outfield, he's going to be one of those guys that has second, short, third, left, center, and right eligibility in June. Yeah. And you're going to be able to plug him in literally everywhere.
And you're going to be so happy about the whole thing. You're going to be like, yes.
Yeah, but Mal, who's your guy?
I'm going to go with Rugi, my dude.
Rugi.
Yeah, look. I mean, he, you know, the reports out of, you know, from him and his prospect profile is that he's got more hit in there than 259. You know, it's, I think that he's one of those guys where, you know, he's got a season under him. He's got 417 plate appearances under him. He's a pretty advanced hitter. He's very young. And I like middle infielders with a hit tool. So, you know, I think he can be a guy who can hit in the 270 to 290 range. And if everything absolutely clicks, you're talking about a 300 plus hitter. So, Odor's, you know, he's in a good park. I mean, the offense is down. Their lineup isn't very good right now. Their team isn't very good right now. There's certainly a lot of bounce back potential there, but I like Odor, and I think that's a guy that you know, I'm targeting pretty aggressively in terms of like a bargain and seeing where I can get him. You know, I'm very eager to see what he does this year.
Sounds good. So that ties nicely into my guy, and I'm going to go with the giving zero fucks approach here, and I am going to go with Jurickson Profar. I adore Jurickson Profar. I think he is going to be a star. I still do. I have no idea if it is going to happen this year, but if he's healthy, and that is obviously the three most important words in the history of fantasy baseball, but if he's healthy, I think he takes the job from Odor, and I think he never gives it back. Profar is still a guy who can contribute everywhere. He can hit for average. He's got some pop. He can steal some bases. He just needs to get back in that rhythm, and I think he does. And I have an irrational love of him. So he's my guy.
That actually went exactly how I thought it was going to go to.
Yeah, pretty much. Taking
so far. Yeah,
yeah.
Would have had no. I would have been. I would have really been. We've had discussion about Profar if you didn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was that?
We would have had a discussion about if you took like, I don't know, if you took Nick Franklin. I'd be like, why didn't you take Profar? We would have had a whole discussion about that. So
yeah, pretty much.
My thing about Profar is, it's the this year thing. I completely agree. He will be a star at some point, and I don't have any doubt about that. You know how that plays out in fantasy. I don't know. My concern is just this year. I really suspect the Rangers are going to be really cautious with him. And there, to me, he comes up if he's hitting like 400 or 450 in the minors and just completely forces the issue, which, given the talent, could happen. But given the nature of that injury, I just feel like there are a lot of unknowns with him.
Wow. Yeah, it's totally fair. There are a ton of unknowns, and we may not even know any of those unknowns before the before mid-March or so. So anyone who's drafting really early is going to have to take a supreme leap of faith on him.
You know, and again, some of this is format dependent. It, quite honestly, in a 12-team mixed, I'd rather take Profar with the reserve pick than Scooter Gennett, who hopefully never graces my roster in a 12-team mixed. in a really deep, deep league, you know, it's NLA, also it's apples to oranges, but you know, Odor or Profar in an AL only, and I'm competing this year, and putting the whole dump consideration aside with Profar, I might rather have Odor just because I know I'm going to get, you know, 250, 300 plate appearances out of him, or I hope, you know, before Profar comes up. But I see the argument. You know, it does happen, you know, and I'll talk about this when we get to third baseman. You do have guys that, you know, actually Lowry's a good example. You do have guys that wind up in that post-hype zone where people push them too far down. And I think, I know it's a rough injury, but I think it's happened with Profar. I think he's been dismissed by some a little too easily. I don't disagree with that at all.
Sounds good. And yeah, for the record, the only way I'm owning Scooter Gennett in a 12-team mixed league is if something really, really terrible happens to Jonathan Lucroy and he becomes their catcher.
Wow, that's a hell of a path to playing time right there, man.
It is. That's a serious path to playing time. So on that note, we are going to take a quick break and come back and wrap things up for you. And we are back. Thank you for listening to episode 39 of Flags Fly Forever. As always, we are a baseball prospectus fantasy podcast. You have been listening to myself, Brett Sayer, Mike Gianella, and Mao, Mauricio Rubio. You can find all of us at baseballprospectus.com and go there today and subscribe. And you will get all of the fantastic content that we are putting out there to get you prepared for your drafts. We are in the middle of our positional series. We have 3 to 4 articles a day coming out specifically on those positions. We are covering them from soup to nuts and then back to soup again. So if you come and join the party, we will welcome you with open arms. And then if you sign up for a super premium membership, you get all the advantages of a premium membership with access to our fantasy answering service, the Bat Signal, and the bane of some of our existences. But we answer any questions you have generally within 12 hours. And believe me, many of our subscribers use it liberally, which we encourage because it's that's what it is there for. Other than that, we will see you again next week, where we will talk about third baseman, because we do not fall slave to counterclockwise movement. We will see you next week. So have a good week, and hopefully James Shields has signed by the time you hear from us next. We will see you later. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
See you next week.
It does go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So
this is true. Well, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
That's true.
Who has the third? Oh, Craig has the.